I'm Dana Lloyd. Welcome to Soul Sister Conversations, the podcast, where you will be inspired and empowered to connect more deeply with your authentic self as we explore topics of personal development, leadership, and spirituality. Your journey to your most authentic self starts right now. The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown is a book that I read about 10 years ago when I was in the middle of my self-discovery journey. I recently reread this book for my book club. You always get something different from a book the second time around. Today, I take you inside Brené Brown's 10 guideposts for wholehearted living that emerged from her research. If you want encouragement to live an authentic life, this is a must read. Well, hello, Soul Sister Conversations listeners. Thank you for tuning in today. And today we're going to be talking about The Gifts of Imperfection. And this is a book by Brené Brown that I read, I've got to guess, about 10 years ago. It's when it first came into my awareness. And of course, it was through the Oprah Winfrey Show. And one of the reasons I was reading it at that time was reading was a big part of how I was figuring out my life. You know, I was trying to answer the question, who am I? What should I do with my life? So I was trying to find different materials that would lead me to those answers. And reading was a big part of it. And The Gifts of Imperfection were one of those books. And the subtitle of this is Let Go of Who You Think You're Supposed to Be and Embrace Who You Are, Your Guide to a Wholehearted Life. And the reason why I want to talk about this is it's fresh in my mind. It's part of the book club selection that I have within my Soul Prescription online group. And because it was the second time that I had read it, I had a different experience reading it. And I thought I would go through and debrief the 10 guideposts that she talks about in this particular book, because they may be useful for you on your journey of discovery and becoming your most authentic self. And they're really great guideposts. And these were guideposts that did hit me in a different way. Some of them that I skimmed over the last time and that I recognize that they're much more profound this time around. And I had a different experience with it this time around because I now live and teach and immerse myself in the language that she uses in this book. So it feels so much more familiar and I can get it easily now, where 10 years ago, I was in a different place. And I don't know if you like to reread books or some of your favorite books, but I'm sure you might have the same experience that you get something different from materials when you go back and re-listen or reread something. And it just has a different effect. And I think it's always valuable. You don't always have to be reading the next new thing. Although even back then and now, when I am trying to figure something out, I like to read all sorts of different texts because I'm trying to find a pattern. Like, what is the answer here? And that's just how I like to approach it. But Brené Brown, as you know, is an international, well-known person with her research on shame and vulnerability. And she was probably one of the first people to bring shame to the forefront as something that you could actually research. And the book that she wrote, The Gifts of Imperfection, is born out of the research of people that she interviewed. And she was even having her own awakening when she was going through this research, and she had to stop. I think she even says in the book that it was like a year, because she had to stop and do her own therapy and figure out her own stuff before she could actually piece all this information together and make sense of it. But again, she calls this the wholehearted living, and she talks about it as being a process. And some of the lines that stood out for me in this book, one of them was, we hustle for our worthiness. Now, isn't that the truth? That you will do things in life to make yourself feel worthy, you know, whether it is, you know, trying to get someone to like you or take a certain job or achieve a certain status to look a certain way. We have to actually drill down and ask ourselves, why are we doing these things? And the line, hustle for our worthiness, just stood out, because we don't have to hustle for our worthiness, yet so often we do, and probably in ways that we're not actually conscious of. So I want to go through the 10 guideposts, and I'm sure you hearing them will maybe bring it back into your awareness or hit you in a different way. And the first one that she talks about is cultivating authenticity. And the subtitle is letting go of what people think. And she says, if we want to experience love and belonging, we have to believe we are worthy of it. And that worthiness just keeps coming up time and time again, linked with shame, this fear of being unlovable because everybody experiences is not reserved for those who have terrible trauma, she says. Right? So often we think shame might be linked to big events. But as we hear now a lot, there's big T and little t trauma, right? So it's the little things in life that can create shame for us. And that authenticity is a practice. This is what she points out and what I believe. I think you can become aware whether you are being authentic or not, but authenticity is actually a conscious choice of how we want to live, not whether, we are authentic or inauthentic. It's a continuous process and a continuous process of checking in with yourself even daily. How are you showing up? Are you putting on airs? Are you trying to be something that you're not? And authenticity is it's what a lot of us are achieving. And it's a word that gets used a lot these days, my most authentic self. And I use it a lot because I know that it resonates with me, that it means it's really be willing to show up as my true self, get on my path, finding my life purpose, living my life with meaning, being able to use my gifts and talents in a way that impacts this world. And I think it's all related to life purpose and meaning. And to live authentically is not to betray yourself. To live authentically is to love yourself. To live authentically is to know that you are worthy. I mean, how powerful is that? And this is not an easy journey, and especially if you're starting to have feelings bubble up inside of you that something's wrong or you're off your path in some way, I feel like that is a divine calling to you to correct course and figure out what is the direction you need to go in. Sometimes it isn't a great big change. Sometimes it's just a small thing. Maybe it's who you're spending time with. Maybe it is finding a new job within your current organization. It mightn't even be doing a completely different career, but it is paying attention to those feelings and signs that bubble up within us. I have an app, a yoga app that I use for daily yoga, or mostly daily yoga, and it's called it's Yoga by Adrienne, but the app is called Find What Feels Good. And she uses this statement a lot in her yoga sessions, because that's the whole point, is move in the direction that feels good. I think when you live authentically, you naturally are moving in a direction that feels good, because if you wake up and you don't feel good, there's something off. It's not just that you're tired or hungry or the basics. Sometimes it's that, but it is recognizing that there's something in your life that you're looking to tweak. And that's what it means to live authentically, is paying attention to those signs. And that's one of the things that came out of her research, is that people who live a wholehearted life are authentic. They choose authenticity every single day. The second guidepost that she talks about that came up in her research is the idea of cultivating self-compassion. And the subtitle for this one is Letting Go of Perfectionism. I know a lot of perfectionists or recovering perfectionists. I'm raising my hand right here, right now, because I'm also a recovering perfectionist. And perfectionism is one of those things that we like to think that we're doing our very best, but we're not. We think that we're actually doing excellent work, but we're not. Perfectionism is another way that we hustle for worthiness. I know for myself, when I would try to be perfect, for example, if it was in school and I was working on a project, it would always be, I've got to study one more hour, or I've got to look at the project one more way to make it perfect. Is it the right sentence? Is it the right thing? Did I do enough? And how do you know when it is enough? And for me, that's about going inward and being satisfied that you've done your very best and recognizing there isn't anything I've overlooked here. You know, perfectionism is really an idea that's born of the ego. And when you're saying, I'm scared that I'm going to fail, or I'm scared I'm not going to get a good enough mark, you're really saying, I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy enough. That I am not enough. And perfectionism is a slippery slope and a very thin line between perfectionism and excellence, because we can fool ourselves into thinking that we're doing excellent work. And Brené Brown outlines a few things around perfectionism. And she says, perfectionism is not the same thing as striving to be your best. As I just said, it's a shield. And in fact, it's really preventing us from taking flight. And perfectionism will constantly move the finish line. I know I've had that experience. You're like, oh, I'll just do it one more time. And then another week is gone by, or another day is gone by, and you still haven't got the thing executed. She also says that perfectionism is not self-improvement. I absolutely agree. You know, I am what I accomplish, and how well I accomplish is the debilitating belief system that she talks about. It has nothing to do with what you're accomplishing and what you're doing. It's not a reflection of yourself, like, how can I improve? How can I be better? Perfectionism is tricky like that. It gets in your head thinking that, I guess at the core, you're trying to get approval and acceptance, right? Again, this idea of hustling for your worthiness. She also says that perfectionism is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that fuels this primary thought. If I look perfect, live perfectly, and do everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize the painful feelings of shame, judgment, and blame. Isn't that the truth? It is very self-destructive. Because to be excellent, to just do your best, requires a lot of vulnerability. And perfectionism feels like white knuckle gripping it through life. You know that if you've ever been a perfectionist. It feels like you can't move. Maybe you can't even breathe because you're afraid that someone is going to make a comment about the work that you've done, which therefore you internalize as a comment on who you are as a person or your worthiness. And it's just not true. We have to learn to separate those. And I always say trade perfection for excellence, because perfectionism will never satisfy you. When you say that you're doing excellent work, you know you're doing your best. I'm going to read on page 59. This is what she says about her research clients. This was the people that learned to live with a wholehearted living spoke about their imperfection, she says, in a tender and honest way and without shame and fear. Second, they were slow to judge themselves and others. They appeared to operate from a place of, we're all doing the best we can. And I think that's very important. And the second part that she mentioned, they were slow to judge themselves and others. I think that people who judge themselves very harshly are also people that judge other people very harshly. You've heard it in your own head first, you know. So it's this idea of letting go. All of it is about letting go. I think Dr. Shefali talks about spirituality, not so much about building something, but actually a process of letting go. We're constantly surrendering or taking away things, subtracting things from our life, not adding things. And often we're subtracting old belief systems, we're subtracting how we think or attitude or mindset. And one of those is perfectionism. So the second guidepost is a really interesting one. Guidepost number three is called cultivating a resilient spirit, letting go of numbing and powerlessness. Now, when I read this the first time around, I don't remember her mentioning the word spirituality. And now my life is all about spirituality, which is really about self-discovery and connectedness to myself and to something greater than me. But one of the things that she recognized in her research was that resilience was connected to spirituality, and people who were resilient in her research had a spiritual practice, and they often practiced compassion. And she describes spirituality as recognizing and celebrating that we are all connected to each other by a greater power than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. And so these people that she was doing research with, she was actually astounded that not one of them that described themselves as resilient didn't have a spiritual practice. Everyone had a spiritual practice. Resilience equals a spiritual practice. So to me, the second time around reading this, because of the space that I'm in, that was quite profound and it made sense to me. I understand what does it mean to be more resilient because you have spirituality in your life, i.e. practice, whether it's gratitude and joy or compassion or even letting go of things like perfectionism. And that's how you be more resilient, is when you're not so hard on yourself. So guidepost number 3 was super interesting to me. Guidepost number 4 was all about cultivating gratitude and joy. And people who were joyful practice gratitude, she found. Gratitude was considered a spiritual practice. And I agree 100%. It was so funny. I kind of laughed out loud at this part. She was talking about the research participants. And she said, these people fool around a lot. And the whole point was that these people knew how to play. They knew how to have fun and go about life with ease. And she quotes a doctor in this section. His name is Dr. Stuart Brown. And he has been quoted as saying, the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. And that just stood out to me on the page, because I hear so much more about that these days, about people being depressed. And we are just overloading ourselves with all the shoulds and the supposeds and how we're supposed to act. I mean, her whole subtitle is let go of who you think you're supposed to be and embrace who you are. And we can get very depressed by the very life that we are living. And the idea that you need to have more play in your life, cultivating gratitude and joy. How do we connect to joy? Because joy is very different than happiness to me. Happiness is an emotion like every other human emotion, but joy is this foundation that runs onto your life that you can choose to connect to. And you can do that in many different ways. And play and having fun and taking yourself not so seriously is one of those ways. So that was a very important guidepost. Number 5 guidepost is cultivating intuition and trusting faith. Now, some of these chapters are less dense than the others, and this one was a smaller chapter, but not any less significant. So the subtitle for this is letting go of the need for certainty. And boy, this is a tough one to do, because I'm someone who likes certainty too. I like certainty. I like structure. Don't like chaos. I'll create structure where there's none. And she says, what silences our intuitive voice is the need for certainty. And it's true. When I was learning to build my relationship with my intuition, I would hear, I can't say I hear that voice, but I would have thoughts or ideas about things, and I just wouldn't pay attention to them really, or I would doubt it. Doubt is a huge one. I would think, is that for me? Is that really true? How will I know that will work? How do I know that's my intuition? And probably that was when I had those questions when I was starting to listen to my intuition. Even before that, I wasn't even questioning it or having doubt. I just doubted myself all the time, but I wasn't even listening to myself. I didn't realize there was a place to go to listen. And once you find that place, it becomes very powerful. And then you have to learn to trust. And trust replaces doubt. And then faith builds. So, as she even says, faith is very mysterious. What is that? But to me, intuition and faith are intangible. We can't put our hands on it. We can't see it, touch it, feel it, but we can sense it. And that's something I pay a lot more attention to now. But when I read this book 10 years ago, this wouldn't have been a chapter that impacted me as much as it does now. Guidepost number 6, cultivating creativity, letting go of comparison. And Brené Brown says, comparison is all about conforming and competition. Like she says on page 95, who has time for painting and scrapbook and photography when the real work of achieving and accomplishing needs to be done? And she really looked at this from her own perspective. Just more work. She's a researcher, work more hours, you know, just put in every, you know, burn the midnight oil or candle or whatever that is. Just do more. And the reason why that was about conforming and competition, because that looks good. Right? Conforming. This is what everybody's doing. You're going to look like a slacker if you're not putting in a bazillion hours. And it's also about competition because it's like, can I get ahead of the person in my department, in my organization? But it becomes very tiring and exhausting. And a word I hear a lot is burnout. People eventually just become burned out because they are tired of the competition. They're tired of having to be compared or even being compared by your boss of you to somebody else, which creates more shame and requires more vulnerability. But creativity is this place where we can get back to basics. How many wellness retreats do you see where people are doing yoga and they're doing painting and they are going for nature walks and they're enjoying food and connection? They are playing. They are getting back to their roots. The very word in creativity, the root word is create from creator. We want to create things. It makes us feel good. And when I wrote my first book, well, before that, I had my list of values that I knew: connection and contribution and humor. But one of the things I realized after I wrote my book is that I had to add the word create. Creativity was a value. And I didn't realize that before, or I certainly invalidated it and didn't realize it was a value. Because a value is something that you must have in your life, something that it's almost like an itch that you have to scratch. And I realized, well, how did I miss that? Because I really enjoyed creating the book, even though it was difficult at times. But that idea of putting something together to take my own thoughts and ideas and make creative choices about how the chapters would go and then naming them and so on, that was fun for me. And that was a way to get back to my creativity. But somehow I had missed and overlooked that. So think about where you're missing creativity in your life. A lot of people say, well, I'm not creative because they can't paint or sculpt like a famous artist. But that's not the point. It's really about this play and getting in touch with that inner voice. That's one way to do it. If you want to build intuition, start doing painting, start, become a gardener and arranging things. Maybe you like that. Creativity can show up in all sorts of ways. It doesn't have to be in painting and sculpting. But it's the idea of letting go again, of conforming, of being competitive, and looking like you're being a slacker, because that's not true. And in fact, you're refueling your soul. Guidepost number seven is cultivating play and rest. It's a perfect segue from cultivating creativity. And she says, let go of exhaustion as a status symbol and productivity of self-worth. Isn't that the truth? Exhaustion as a status symbol, right? And you hear it with people a lot. They go, oh, I'm busy. I'm so busy. Busy, busy, busy. Busy doing what? Are you having fun? We're just filling in time. When I was growing up, a word I would often hear with some of my older relatives was this exchange they would have with each other. How are you passing the time? And that would always sort of stick out in my mind. Like, how are you passing the time? And I look at it now, I'm like, I'm not trying to pass time, like fill it in with puzzles and crocheting. I want to make something of my time, feel like I'm using my life for good. But again, don't mistake that for wearing yourself thin. It's more about using my gifts and talents in this world to help and to serve other people. But this idea of play and rest as a status symbol is something that I see a lot. And again, people use the word burnout, and people are just burned out. And I hear a lot of people say, my soul is tired. And I never knew what that really meant, because I thought, I heard bone tired, but not soul tired. And I thought, well, if your soul is supposed to be infinite and the impersonal part of you, shouldn't it be well rested and raring to go and always cheering you on? And me, my human self might be tired, but why is my soul tired? And I think I've come to understand what soul tired means. Your soul is tired of watching you go against what it knows you want. It is sighing continuously, like large exhale, because you're not paying attention to it. It is tired of exhaling. It is tired of waving its arms in the air, like someone who's shipwrecked on a deserted island who wants to be rescued. And it's like, over here, pay attention. And your soul becomes tired when you do things that you don't want to do them longer than you want to do, when you constantly betray yourself by hustling for your worthiness, by not willing to be authentic and truly yourself and put yourself out there, and with fear, because your fear of being judged. All of those reasons can be so exhausting. So I think it's really important to cultivating play and rest, and it moves right in with creativity, to go back to doing the things that you love. One of the things that I did about 7 years ago, I took up hockey. And it occurred to me one day, I got to play with a friend of mine who had joined at the same time. And we were hustling for the puck in the corner and chasing each other. And, you know, we're not really good at it. We're just okay. We were learning, but it was fun. And I remember us falling to the ground and laughing and scrambling to try to get the puck in the net, and the other person trying to stop I'm trying to stop her and then she's trying to stop me, and we're laughing and giggling and yelling at each other, and then we're just laying on the ice looking up at the ceiling of the rink, and I was thinking, where and when have I ever done this since I was like 10, where I can lie on the ice in public and have fun and laugh, and it's just so good for the soul. And I realized it's that kind of play that we don't get to do much anymore. And to find ways to bring that silliness and happiness and simplicity back into your life. Guidepost number 8 is about cultivating calmness and stillness. Now, when I read this 10 years ago, I must have breezed past this section because I had lots of things highlighted in this book. There wasn't much highlighted in this particular chapter. And so when I read it this time around, I understood the power of calmness and stillness because I do this more now. Back then, didn't even know where to find it. Wouldn't sit down long enough to understand or connect with calm. And she says, if we choose to heal with calm, we have to commit to practicing calm. That's why a lot of people have meditation practices. But you don't have to have that. You just may have to commit to taking a time out in your day to sit and close your eyes, maybe just sit and read, to go for a walk by yourself without music in your ears. Something where you begin to get in touch with who you are. And as Brené says, stillness is not about focusing on nothingness. It's about creating a clearing. I like that. We're just clearing a space, clear a space in your day even, just so you can even stand still. When have you done that? You're buzzing about your office or going about your house looking after your children, and where you could actually just sit still, stand still, and just feel all that energy rushing and stopping so that you can just connect with you. It's pretty powerful. And that guidepost stood out to me as one that I really didn't pay attention to before, but that I do have in my life a lot more now. And I'm grateful that I've been able to find that space more often. Number 9, she says, wholehearted living has to do with cultivating meaningful work, letting go of self-doubt and supposed to. And it's true. How many times do we do things that we think we're supposed to do, you know, versus what we just really, truly want to do? And then actually move, find what feels good, move in that direction. And in this particular chapter, she talks about gremlins. And in coaching, that's a term that we use a lot, gremlins or saboteur or inner critic. And she says gremlins are like toddlers. If you ignore them, they get louder. And so you have to begin paying attention to those incoming messages. And if you choose to ignore those incoming messages, you get more soul exhaustion, right? So if people think, well, that's silly, that won't be looked at as valuable, or I should do this because it's a status symbol, you know, it's more valuable than this kind of work, another kind of work, you will exhaust yourself. So let go of the self-doubt and what you think you're supposed to do, and go in and search what you want to do. And that will be meaningful work. Not work that the world thinks is meaningful. What do you think is meaningful? And lastly, guidepost number 10 is all about cultivating laughter, song, and dance. Letting go of being cool and always in control. And this takes me back to, again, my example of me playing hockey with my friend. Being silly and goofy on the ice is good for the soul. I mean, how good is a belly laugh with a friend? Or dancing out in your kitchen, or singing at the top of your lungs in your car, and you're thinking, wow, I really nailed that today. That's when we we can just let go. And I know I love dancing. I love going to dances, and you don't get to do that much anymore with the world that we're living in. And even before that. But if you have an opportunity to be able to dance to music and just move your body without judgment. I had heard someone say to me when I was on the dance floor that she couldn't raise her hands above her head, that that was too vulnerable for her, like letting loose. And I was like, oh, really? And mine will be waving above my head, or, I love to dance, and I really actually am not all that conscious of myself when I'm on the dance floor. Maybe I should be. No, I shouldn't be. But you realize for some people, they will not let loose in any way, shape, or form. And you pay a price for that. But that's why we have to do it within the confines of our own home. Maybe that makes you feel amazing. But to really show up and show the world that you can be goofy and play, I think it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But that's who you were. You think of a child or a toddler, how they dance to the music, they're not concerned about what other people think. And that's the beauty of being a child. You can show up in all your glory without the care of what other people think. And boy, if we could take that with us and not care about what other people think, that would be so powerful. So if you haven't read The Gifts of Imperfection, or you haven't read it in a long time, I always recommend that that's a good idea. The Gifts of Imperfection. These are great reminders, and I think you will relate to Brené Brown because she's and every kind of woman, the kinds of stuff that she admits will make you laugh out loud because you've probably done them with your family or with your coworkers. And I think it's always nice to know you're not alone when you're on the road to figuring out who you are and to live a wholehearted life. And I'll end this episode with the last paragraph from her book. And she says, revolution might sound a little dramatic. But in this world, choosing authenticity and worthiness is an absolute act of resistance. Choosing to live and love with our whole hearts is an act of defiance. You're going to confuse, piss off, and terrify lots of people, including yourself. One minute you'll pray that the transformation stops, and the next minute you'll pray that it never ends. You'll also wonder how you can feel so brave and so afraid at the same time. At least that's how I feel most of the time. Brave, afraid, and very, very alive. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and maybe this will inspire you to think about living your wholehearted life in a completely different way. That was such a great conversation. If you loved it too, subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. Please go to iTunes to rate and review this podcast. And if you want to continue the conversation, connect with Soul Sister Conversations on the Facebook and Instagram pages. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook at Dana Lloyd Leadership, on Twitter at Coach Dana_Lloyd, and of course on LinkedIn. See you next week.